Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k. Welcome, everybody, to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast, where each week we bring you education and information that will help you take your next step in building wealth through real estate. My name is Lauren Wells. I've been absent from quite a few episodes, traveling around to different conferences, but I am here today back again with my co-host, Chris Seveny. And today we have the pleasure of having Romney Navarro, CEO of Streamline Funding, with us today to talk about persevering when scaling your business and really kind of talking about that in relationship to where we are in today's economic climate. So welcome, Romney. Happy to have you. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself for our audience?
Well, thanks for having me, Lauren. Thanks for having me, Chris. Really cool to be on the show. I hope the millions and millions of listeners worldwide get some value out of this thing. But even if it's the few, definitely want to always make a connection. We just met and we established a great relationship. I just kind of loved you guys' vibe and your energy. It's an honor to be here because I love to feed off of it. With that said, who am I and what do I do? And a little bit of that. My name, as she mentioned, is Romney Navarro. I am the CEO of Streamline Funding. Streamline Funding is a private lending institution based out of Austin, Texas. We've been at it for going on 20 years. Come December, we're going to be 20 years old. And that's pretty wild. I can't believe we've been doing it this long. We wrote our very first loan out of the back of a Toyota Corolla. And now we manage about $200 million in investor capital, which is placed around across a number of different loans throughout the state of Texas and the South, very select markets throughout the country, not necessarily only the South. For the last 7 years, we have been building a business to help the builders, the home builders grow. And we continue to do that today. And what we've expanded kind of when we say builder, to be more than just home builder. Now we're talking about the portfolio builder, the legacy builder, the wealth builder. Creating Wealth Simplified podcast kind of plays into what we're doing. We're looking to kind of give people the fuel to basically grow their nest egg, their retirement, you name it. And as a hard money lender or private lender is what we're referred to as, it's hard to see how that works. But when you're giving people financing to acquire more assets, it's exactly how that works. So I'm a hard money lender, been doing it forever. And as we navigate through some more kind of unique waters, it's going to be interesting to see how things grow.
A lot to unpack there. I was like writing some questions down as you were going. Saying 20 years, assuming since you said your first deal was written out of Toyota Corolla, that you've been with the company all 20 years.
It's a good question. I have not, believe it or not. My business partner founded the company. His name is Jaden Newman. He founded the company in December 20-something, 2002, when we wrote our very first loan. So like I said, we'll be turning 20 now in the next couple of months. I actually got here, believe it or not, smack dab in the middle of the Great Recession. So yeah.
What landed you here? Like, how did that come about?
Dude, great question. Let me give you a time period in case the people that are listening to could relate. I'm talking September 2008.
I'm familiar with it.
Yeah, middle, where the biggest pain point was happening. So I'd been a commercial lender for a number of years leading up to that. I was a pretty young dude at the time, certainly younger than I am now. And what it was, I was doing loans, small balance commercial loans. I was financing retail centers, office buildings, multifamilies for entrepreneurs. And it was going great in my early to mid 20s. Making a little bit of money and things are going well. We get married, have a kid, start a family, buy a house. You know how that thing goes. I'm kind of midstream. Everything's rocking. Everything's rolling. At some point in 2008, the company that I was working for, certainly if you check my bio, you know who it is, but big national firm. Actually, I'll tell you, it was called Bayview Financial, big firm. They said, you guys would be very familiar with that group.
Yes.
Well, in addition to servicing notes, Bayview also had an origination arm, and that origination arm was called Silver Hill Financial. And I was working there and life was good. And at one point in 2008, they said, hey, this whole loan origination thing, we're pumping the brakes. We're actually going to stop originating loans because it's just getting weird out there. And I felt it. I wouldn't call myself a kid, but I was a kid. I wasn't really paying attention to it. I was just trying to close deals. Long story short, I'm unemployed. And I realized, damn, I've got this giant pipeline of deals that I can't monetize. I can't make money off of, but I need to make money because I've got a young family. Oh, and by the way, my wife is now X number of months pregnant with our second kid. So that pressure was building up. So I was like, let me go to Google. Imagine 2008 Google. It was a little bit different, but I was like, Google, how do I fund a loan? And Google says, have you heard of this thing called hard money? And I was like, what the hell is hard money? Is the next question I ask. And it's like, tell me what that is. And then it's like, who are the hard money lenders in town? And I found four different hard money lenders and I called them. Every single one of them is my friend till this very day. Some of my competitors now, but my friend. Anyway, I walked in to this one company that showed interest in one of the deals that I was trying to place. I was trying to place the deal because I realized if I close it, I make this big commission and everything's back to normal and where these things happen. Very broker mentality. So I put this deal in front of this group and 30, 45 minutes of just kind of getting filleted, like with a million questions. They're like, all right, do you have a minute? I was like, let me look at it. Of course I have a minute. I'm unemployed. Do I have a minute? So they asked me the question. I was like, yeah, for sure. So I wait for 2-3 minutes and in comes in this dude, like 6'5", 300 pounder, comes in and he's like, hey, I like your deal. It's cool. He's, do you want a job? Yeah, I want a job. Let me consult with my people. And I took, you know, of course I want a job, dude. What does that entail? It's like, whatever. So anyway, that company was Streamline Funding. So I presented a deal to then the CEO and then the founder, well, I guess still the founder, Jaden. And he offered me a job some years later as we kind of powered through the recession, because that's what it took. It was powering through. It wasn't business as usual. Yeah. We became a partner in the firm, took on more responsibility, more equity, all of these great things. And we're kind of a unique bird in that we are more than just private lenders. Part of our kind of broader universe is private equity, wealth management, real estate, all these things we also do. Jaden, myself, and a couple of other, we had two other partners. We kind of each handled one of those legs, for lack of a better term. And I've always been on the private lending side. And then kind of dawned on us about a year ago that it's time to scale it again. We've scaled it a few times. And it was at that point where I took on the title and the responsibility of CEO. I think I've always been by definition that role, but now it's by title. So started as a kind of lowly loan officer. All these guys out here making calls for me right now, I was one of them 12, 13 years ago. Fast forward to today, I'm running this place and I'm trying to grow it to a $1 billion shop.
I love that you give perspective on like the time frame, because I think a lot of people who are getting into real estate, whether actively or passively, think of it, and I think social media does not help this over the past few years, of it being like this overnight success. And so I love when we speak with people who talk about how they've been in this for over a decade.
Yeah.
That shows that it's not this overnight. Look at where you are now, but that's not where it started. I was in like cold calling, doing deals. So that's super awesome. And really, the power of the internet, like you Googling, what is hard money lender? What is hard money? How do I do this? How do I make money? Also speaks to something even more powerful now that there's so much information out there. Just being able to go watch free content, not necessarily pay someone to like mentor or coach you or whatever they want to call it these days, is again, even better than it was 10, 15 years ago. One thing I had a question about was, you said for our audience, like backing up a little bit. So our audience is pretty broad, for people who are seasoned investors to just starting out. So can you explain and break down what a hard money loan is, what private lending is? Can you talk about the players? And this is where like A goes to B goes to C. This is what we do.
Sure. And I'll try to break it down into a couple of components, because I've got a couple of books back here. I don't think you can see them. There they are. I guess you could say I'm an avid reader. I try to crush a book a week, and I'm not always that good. Sometimes I'm reading one. Sometimes I'm listening to one. Oftentimes I'm doing both at the same time. And about 10 years ago, the book was already aged a little bit, but about 10 years ago, I read one that I wouldn't call it life-changing, but certainly created it restructured my way of thinking. The book was called The Blue Ocean Strategy.
That's a good one. I recommend that to me. To read it.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah. Is that what I see back over there? That little blue one over there?
And I don't think so. I think it's actually upstairs in my wife's office.
I haven't read it in a long time, but I remember it was eye-opening.
Yeah, and I'm gonna butcher it because I've kind of interpreted it as my own version. But the Blue Ocean, for the people that are listening to the podcast right now or that are watching this, the Blue Ocean Strategy, very simple, as I explain it to people that I kind of am around. Mind you, I read this 10 years ago, probably 5 years ago again, but I always kind of land on a red ocean is where everybody is fighting for the same thing. A red ocean being shark-infested waters. There's one piece of meat and all the sharks are attacking. A blue ocean is when one of those sharks kind of swims away and creates kind of their own little paradise of whatever they want. So I've always been a blue ocean thinker. I've always wanted to be a little different than the competition. If they're going that way, I kind of always want to go this way. And it's really hard to do that when times are so great. We've been on a mental run for the last 10. Some sage advice I got a million years ago was, when times are going good, it's okay to do the same stuff. I was going to drop an S-bomb on you guys. My bad.
Okay.
But when times are not going good, you have to do something different. I came up in a time where times were not going good. So I always had to do something different. And it's always been my strategy and it's always worked. So when I talk about private money, I could talk about it kind of at the institutional level, or I could talk about it the way that I've done it. I think both are important. Institutionally speaking, in October 2022, there are large-scale institutions that provide lending criteria to brokers across the country. And these lending criteria are like nothing any conventional loan has ever seen before. They're ratio driven, but they're not income driven, credit driven, so on and so forth. So if somebody wants to buy a piece of real estate and doesn't want to go the traditional route, hard money is kind of the place to do that. As a result of kind of the ease of transacting, hard money is going to charge you more. Yeah, let's say in the last year, hard money rates have been like plummeting. Rates were as low as 7% for a hard money loan. Fast forward to today when the market's changed, we're back in the 12s and 13s. That's the world that we live in. I grew up in that world. So instead of necessarily focusing on what the large scale institutions were saying, give me this type of property, give me this type of asset, we went out and raised our own capital. So I kind of did a little picture with my hands and I said,
this will be on YouTube. So if anyone needs to see the visuals, head on over there.
If this is my universe and I have a private lending firm, a private equity firm, a real estate firm. Down here, I have this wealth management firm. We raised a lot of money to finance all of these projects that we're talking to by way of our wealth management firm. So as a result of being a true private lender, some people call me a balance sheet lender. I've shown you guys a few deals on my balance sheet. We basically originate loans based on the money that we have available inside of our funds. So what that does is a couple of things. It gives us the ability to just cut a no-nonsense deal. If it makes sense, we do it. And that's what ultimately hard money is. It's what is it that we're looking for in a deal? And we make a decision based on this common sense approach. My common sense approach, I always narrow it down to what we call the 5 C's. 5 C's are really important in my world because it's frankly how we make a decision. And everybody has their version of this. This is my proprietary blend, but it's just the way that I make a decision. Sometimes the C's get reweighted, the weight distribution gets changed. I can tell you right now, it's absolutely changing. But those 5 C's, keeping it real simple, is collateral. So what is the real estate that we're lending on? Credentials. What is the experience of the sponsor? Have they done this before? And how many times and so on? Cash. What is the liquidity of the sponsor? Monies with deals with a lot of liquidity are stronger than deals with a little liquidity. Credit. What is the credit of the sponsorship? Typically, a 500 credit score does not pay and an 800 credit score does. And of course, character. Is this person that we're going to lend $100,000 to, $1 million, maybe not $100 million bucks. I've never done that deal, but $10 million bucks. What is the character? If there's like white collar kind of financial crimes background, it's high likelihood we're going to get screwed out of a deal. So we're looking at those 5 C's. All 5 C's are never going to be lit up. That's a bankable deal. So we exist for the scratch and dent stuff. 3 of those 5 C's in place, we're going to figure something out. 4 of those 5 C's all day long. So that's what hard money is. A little bit of common sense, non-industry, non-institutional, non-agency underwriting, if you will.
A few things. One is, Lauren, back to what he said earlier, he tells you how to accept a job. Somebody asks you if you want a job by saying, yes, I want a job. Well, it's not a no response.
Apparently, I'm a good negotiator, just like slyly.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's interesting you mentioned about the 5 C's because I was speaking to another person in a conference and they mentioned they enjoy lending to people who actually don't need the money. It's like people can use the money, but it's not the people who are desperate for the money is the type of people you want to lend to based on that experience. Now, one question I was going to ask is, so you're doing this lending, are you doing it through like a Regulation D 506C offering or how is it structured with the lending with your investors? And I mean, you mentioned the different companies. I was just curious, what is your overall high level structure look like?
Sure. It'll take me a minute to unpack, but I'll say yes. I have a D fund. I have inside of, then that fund splits into two. I have a qualified fund and a non-qualified fund. Difference between the two is retirement funds and cash, non-retirement funds. And then we have a couple of those. So we have the big funds are what we call our income funds, are split into a qualified and a non-qualified fund. And then we have a couple of secondary funds, which are more equity funds. Large ones that I speak of are the ones that we lend off of. Small ones that I speak of are the ones that we invest in real estate.
Okay.
As I mentioned, we have a real estate investing arm. It's called Emerge Investment Group. They're making investments in real estate, whether passively or actively, still pseudo active, even on the passive side. And what they are is basically the equity partners to some of our premier clients who are scaling their business from, say, one house a quarter to 10 houses a quarter. Okay. So we have a pretty unique fund structure in that we have a number of them. In addition, though, Chris, that's not where we came from. This is something that we learned back in about 2015 and 16. The industry started getting a little bit more sophisticated and kind of pushed us to the fund towards a fund structure. Prior to that, I was 100% direct investment. Wow. You and Lauren might each have 100 grand and I have a $200,000 deal. And I call you and I say, hey guys, I need 100 grand. And you ask me a million questions and then you wire it, not to me and not to a fund, but to the title company.
Yeah.
That was my business model from 2008 to 2014-ish. And then we transitioned to the fund model. It created a lot of efficiency for us. I no longer had to do the same thing 1,000 times. I literally did it once. And it created some security for the investors too. There's a lot of benefits in that. And honestly, to this day, I still use the same two things. The same two things are true today as they were 7 years ago. And the first one is, if you do a single deal, a single trust deed loan, you have the chance of success or failure. If the deal goes upside down or bust or belly up, you have all of that risk is on you. Yep. If the deal goes great, all of that upside is for you too. Whereas a fund kind of makes it a little bit more uniform when you're sitting on 200 assets, if you will, inside of one fund. So it's diversity is one of the key things that's good for a fund. And secondly, and I think you guys talk about this probably now more than ever, but I believe investors, I'm talking about the people who are making cash investments. I'm not talking about the operators that are out there, the blood, sweat, and tears guys that are trying to create lift on a property.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the check writers. I think the safe money right now is trending towards debt, stuff like what we do. Debt is a lot safer today than equity. It's always the case, but equity's all over the place at the moment.
So your business is, when we look at like us with our notes and stuff, you're really doing the same thing. You're originating notes for lenders and so forth. And again, you're at the top of the food chain from that. And yeah, we're seeing a lot of people shift from markets and conventional real estate, especially as people get worried about prices. And that's one of the first questions they ask us is, well, if the price goes down and we mentioned, well, we're buying it the loans at a discount that are non-performing, the value isn't as important in our business model. So I think as an alternative investment strategy, it does open up more opportunity for us. And I know Lauren can talk a lot more about that because she's the one who's on the phone 23 hours a day talking to investors.
Yeah, I could talk about that all day, but I won't on this podcast. Give me a little break here. I guess looking throughout your career, you entered it at a down market. And here we are kind of going back into one. What are some things people who are looking to start now, like you started back in 2008 in whatever avenue of real estate, what are some like tips for them that you would have?
Wow. So here's something that I'm saying a lot right now. I think that is deep because I think the gurus are saying all in because they're trying to get the dollars, right? They're trying to get the memberships and so on and so forth. And you know what? Good on them. I think the vast majority of people are like, I'm not touching it. I think that's a very kind of common theme. But here's something that I think is true. And this is where you enter the space. So that's the next question. But one thing is true. And I'm going to use Austin, Texas, my backyard as the example. Every market across the country is different. But listen, we're not insulated to rate hikes and cooling off inflation. We're all experiencing some value adjustments.
Yeah.
So Austin, Texas, 9 months ago, the average home was upwards of $500,000. That was the sale price. Today, the average home is selling for about $420,000. That doesn't mean the world is falling. I think that means that real estate is on sale. Okay. So when you go to a store and you go and you look at a shirt and you're like, oh, it's $120, put it back on the shelf and whatever. And then you go back a couple weeks later and it's on sale for $65. You're like, I'm going to buy it. Maybe those numbers aren't good. Maybe I should have said the shirt was on sale for $20.
Whoa.
And this jacket is a perfect example. It's raining here, guys. I feel like such a tool. But seriously, if you go to the store and your thing is, and then you go back to it 3 months later and it's a fraction of X, you're more than likely to. So I think right now, even with a increased interest rate kind of environment that we're in, and we all know what it is, we went from 2.7 to the low and we're sitting somewhere in that 7.2, 7.3 right now. Buying power is limited. People who have cash don't have the same problem. I think they can buy real estate right now at a discount. So where do you enter the space? I don't know exactly where to point people's guns at, but if you're sitting on some cash, it's one of two things. It's the safe investment, which is the stuff that we do. Not a discounted note guy, but a note guy. Notes are safe or opportunistic, and that's just real estate. Buy the actual hard asset because it's worth 20% less than it was worth 9 months ago. And guess what? It always bounces back to higher than it was before. So it's kind of like a clearance sale going on right now.
Yeah, I was talking to someone else about this in relationship to job hunting as well, because we're seeing all these layoffs and we were talking about how it's really like, how long can you stay in the market? Like you said, if you buy like an actual property, you're buying it at a discount, it's going to go back up. You just can't expect it to go back up in like the COVID fashion of 200% in a year or whatever. So being able to sit and hold and just be like in whatever you're in. And then, like you said, everything's on sale. There's a lot. I feel like there's going to be a lot of opportunity to be had for people who are willing to kind of take a little bit of risk on if they have the cash.
Yeah. I'm just in the office next door to me. I've got one of my colleagues. I've worked with him for 5 years, 6 years, and he manages our construction portfolio. When you put the word construction in front of anything, it seems a little blue collary. This is not this guy at all. This guy's a borderline genius. I hate that he's so much smarter than me. I hate those people. This guy, but he challenges me almost at a like academic level. And he asked me yesterday, if we're in a bear market, how does somebody know if they're buying right? I was like, damn, that's kind of hitting me right in the guts, because at the end of the day, I'm not only am I financing it, but I'm trying to explain to my audience that it is the right time to buy. And he's saying, how do they know they're buying? And I actually can't say that I know the answer to the question. I can't take it all the way to the end, but I could tell you that if it was worth 500 then and it's worth 420 now, there's a discount on the table. Doesn't mean today's value is 500. It means once we get out of it, it's worth more than 500. So it's better to buy at 420, funny number, than it is to buy at 500. So that's one thing that's true. I also think there's something to be said about the long-term hold. So as it relates to just a general investment strategy, notes are long-term plays sometimes. In my world, they're short-term plays, but some hard assets are long-term plays, rental property in particular. I think right now is a really great time to get into that, because even with all this, everything is rainbows and sunshine that I'm kind of telling you guys, at the end of the day, people aren't buying houses, but people still need a place to live. So people are renting houses. I think a rental strategy is a strong one, especially if you're buying at a discount. So I think, Lauren, you started the conversation. I wrote down persevering and scale. And I think of the word innovation. I'll never forget in 2008, like I said, I was making a little bit of money, but just the dude worked doing a job. And then I lost my job. And then I found the job and I'm financing all these properties, but not really in a position to buy. But I remember seeing some deals that were insane for the next 3-4 years. It was just like, you're telling me I could buy 100 acres for pennies? Let's do that. The term that kind of came into focus in those days, that post-recessionary period, was dry powder. Everybody knows the term. It's kind of buzzy. And I'm thinking, man, if my clients only had dry powder, they would be buying the entire city or the state or the country. Who has dry powder is the big guys, the Blackstones, the Greystones. These firms are buying up a lot of real estate because they have dry powder. So through innovation, I'm trying to work on a dry powder line of credit to allow my clients who have some liquidity, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, allow them to leverage that into $600,000, $700,000, $800,000, $900,000, $1,000,000 of buying power so that they could take advantage of this discount market. So instead of buying it last year for $500,000, they could buy it right now for $420,000. Maybe they could buy it next year for $380,000, but they're taking advantage of the discount. So I'm trying to work through a dry powder line of credit to give people who are interested in a long-term strategy a real chance, because there's not that many offers being made on these properties nowadays.
No, there's not.
And like you mentioned with the store example of, yeah, the shirt's $60. Unfortunately, that person's credit card interest rate went from 12% up to 28%. And all of a sudden, it's, whoa, wait a second here. And that's what I think we're starting to see a lot with housing. And like you mentioned, the dry powder deals. And I was speaking with a multifamily investor the other day, and he basically said the same thing, because right now interest rates are above the cap rates. So it's causing basically, there's not a lot of multifamily deals getting done at this point in time, unless it's a firm that's got a lot of cash, a real good value add for them that they can pick it up at a heavy discount, cash, get the value add, then turn around and basically get thing reappraised, refinance, and basically enhance some of that returns. But yeah, I think we're starting to, like you mentioned, now is going to be a time, for my personal opinion, but I'm always wrong anyways, over the next 12 to 18 months, there's going to be a lot of opportunity in real estate. And for us in the note space, it's typically the lag is a little longer because it's going to take a little longer for people to go delinquent. And then for those loans from BlackRock and these huge private equity firms and REITs that hold a lot of these assets, to make its way down here as well. But I'm curious though, with the hard money stuff that you're doing in on the construction, is a lot of it single family type stuff, or is it commercial, or what's your portfolio mix?
Sure. Today, my portfolio consists of entirely residential with an asterisk. And the asterisk is that there is some multifamily. So long as you could rest your head on in the property, something that I would do. We decided to do that also back in 2010. I was doing commercial deals left and center. As I mentioned, I was actually a commercial lender prior to coming to Streamline. And then that was part of the match made in heaven. It's this dude's got a pipeline and we've got some dollars and let's make it all happen. And commercial loans are interesting. Commercial real estate is interesting, but generally speaking, the volatility is not one that we were very excited in. When you're talking about like in recessionary times, one of the things that happens is people don't spend as much. If times are tough, you don't go to that extra dinner. You don't spend the night at a hotel. You don't take your clothes to the dry cleaner. You don't buy the shirt for $60. You wait for it to be $12. So that type of stuff starts happening. So we just pivoted and said residential. This was kind of a very, elementary kind of thought at the time, but everybody always needs a roof to over their head. And that's still very much true to this day, but it's also plus the fact that how much is it worth and can people buy it? There's all those other factors. So we've always been a residential firm and we still are to this day. We really took a lot of risk pre-COVID and post-COVID in some of the larger scale deals. Like it wouldn't hurt me one bit to do a $2 million spec a couple miles from my office. I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole today. Okay. Because that $2 million spec is going to be sitting on the market for 2 million years or 40. I don't know how long, but it's not is going to be a $300,000 bread and butter home, which if times get real tough, you could just slap a tenant in there and throw it into a 30-year mortgage, whatever that may mean, interest rate wise or whatever. So I really still am incredibly bullish on residential, but I'm more bullish, if you will, on that middle market and not the upper market. Yeah. But Chris, you asked the question, residential or multifamily, and I'm sitting on my whiteboard up here. We just approved a $6 million multi. It's 48 units and I approved it at 70% loan. So I'm saying 6 million. Those are very loose numbers. The guy bought the land for X. I think he bought it for 500. I know he bought it for 500 and he's putting $7.5 million into the vertical construction, horizontal and vertical, excuse me. So that's $8 million of cost. I'm lending him 70% of that number. So I might actually be lending him less than six. There was zero chance that sponsor would have taken that loan 9 months ago because the market was in a place where it was offering him 85%. Today I'm offering 70 and I feel a little bit of, God, I'm sorry, I wish I could do more. But the fact of the matter is there is a lot of risk in speculative building at the moment. Mm-hmm. The equity has to absorb more of that risk to allow the debt to frankly finance the project. And the same isn't totally true for that kind of bread and butter little house that already exists. A lot of us are willing to take risk on those deals. It's these speculative plays that are a little bit risky, a lot riskier. Yeah.
Chris, mm-hmm. Do you have any final thoughts?
I don't actually. He covered a lot of the questions that I was looking for on things, but I'll let you.
Well, I have a final question because you kind of already answered like your advice that you would give to someone entering the market, which I usually ask at the end, but it just fit right there. Since you're a big reader, what is your most recent read and what is your favorite other than Blue Ocean? That can't be it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give you my favorite first. It rolls right into the question of what is the strategy? I read this as a young man. I have a 13-year-old kid and a 13-year-old boy and a 16-year-old girl.
Whoa,
required reading at the house, by the way. There's this little book. It's called The Richest Man in Babylon. I get goosebumps thinking about it. Let's make those decisions. Young people, don't make other decisions. Be that guy. The gist is invest and invest well, and everything will fall into your favor. Obviously, we're investment managers in some capacity, 70 Streamline. So look at us as potential vehicles for that. But The Richest Man in Babylon maybe changed my life. I wish my dad and my mom would have told me about that book when I was a kid, but unfortunately I had to stumble across it later on. Man, I try to do a lot of reading and I read a lot of weird things. I read one the other day. Here's one. It was interesting because sharks are starting to enter the space. And I'm not necessarily saying that this is a sharky book, but it's a reminder of kind of intentions. So I read The Prince by Machiavelli 3 weeks ago. And it's stuck because I see some of those actions kind of happening now, absolute power moves going on. It's just a reminder, not necessarily what not to be. It's a strategy. It works.
Yeah.
But it's a reminder of ulterior motives. And I told you that about a year ago, I took on the position, the title of CEO. And I remember talking to my wife and she's like, what are you going to do? It's like, I don't know, babe. I just got to grow this thing, right? But there was a book that I read that I thought was really interesting because it kind of brought things into perspective. And it's so silly, the title, but it's so such a bullseye, the title. It says a CEO only does three, and it's people, culture, and numbers. There's a couple other things. I would probably add a fourth, but I'll spare you those details.
Oh, what's your fourth? Add the fourth. Do it.
I don't remember. It's on my board somewhere. It's
board other options.
Yeah, that's private. You have to pay for that. That's because I can't remember.
Intellectual property.
Yeah, it was related to numbers. It was basically measuring, but people, culture, and numbers. People, culture, and numbers. In fact, I have a folder back here. My three things. Yeah. So this is my people, culture, and numbers right in here. So that was a really good one. I could go on and on, but the richest man in Babylon, favorite, people, culture, and numbers, if you're trying to do something special. And then Machiavelli, the prince, if you want to see what the boogeyman looks like.
In my case, you want to be thrown back into college where I first said
You go to engineering school, they don't give you books like that. So you don't have to worry about it.
I was a poli sci major. It was like all those books, like all day.
Love it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Chris, do you have any final thoughts or want me to wrap this up?
I'll let you wrap it up. I just enjoyed this episode. Again, it was just great to hear perspective from somebody who's continuing to grow their business and give some insight about what to look for and also perseverance and give people kind of ideas of how to balance their own lives. I'll let you wrap it up, Lauren.
And how to think outside the box. I think that's something that you did and continue to do really well at Streamline Stuff. Thank you everyone for joining us today on this episode of the CWS podcast. If you enjoyed the show, share it with a friend, subscribe, or leave us a review. Till next time. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show, and leave us a review.